Coming up next is the Independent News Hour with John Charlton right here over WBAI New York.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent News Hour. I'm John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of The Independent, New York City's lefty newspaper and website. You can find our beautiful April print edition in our red and white news boxes across the city and in more than 60 public libraries and other venues. We are also online at independent.org, independent.org. My co-host, Amber Gagarian, is off today. We have a couple of fantastic guests lined up for you today in today's show. But first, WBAI is in the middle of an emergency fund drive this week to cover the back rent at 4 Times Square where our antenna and transmitter are installed. These are key items to keep working. Joining me to talk about that is WBAI's program director, Linda Perry.
Hey, John.
Hi, Linda. It's great to be with you.
You too. So you just ran into BAI from where?
Well, I came from over where
I
was in Manhattan.
Were you in Manhattan? Did you see any of the indie news boxes, any of the boxes as you were coming here?
Yeah, definitely. And we have a couple of boxes here in the neighborhood. So when I got off the F train, we have a box right by the Bergen Street station.
Yeah, it's quite a venture, actually, in this day and age to be able to have concrete papers in any of these boxes. You know, there's very few left in the city.
Yeah, that's for sure. Sometimes it feels like it's us and El Especialito, the Spanish language paper.
Yeah. So that's quite an enterprise. How do you do it? You do it monthly, right? But how do you get it together? What goes into it?
Right. We do publish monthly, usually 20-page papers, sometimes as many as 24 pages. We have a mostly volunteer staff, kind of like here at WBAI. It's a labor of love for everybody who's involved. We have two staff people, myself and Amba. Amba had another obligation today and couldn't be with us.
She's wonderful on the air, by the way.
She's our associate editor and also the co-host on this show on many of many times when we come on the air. Mm-hmm. And she's been a fantastic addition. She sounds great on the air, and she's wonderful to work with on a day-to-day.
And her musical choices are really good, I think, too.
Yeah, her father has a musical background.
Uh-huh.
And I think he used to perform on WBAI like 40 years ago.
I think I heard something about that. That's interesting.
Yeah, he's a really talented jazz musician.
So the Independent didn't used to be 20 or 25 pages. It used to be what, 5 pages, 4 pages, 5 pages?
I mean, look, we've been publishing since 2000, so we're in our 24th year.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Here in New York. And sure, the first edition we ever put out was a 4-page black and white paper, and then it became gradually 8 pages and then 16. And, we went to a more full color look, which advertisers also like, but we thought looks really good. And we just, more and more people became involved over time, writers, illustrators, photographers, designers. And it's a huge collective project to assemble a newspaper. And again, we're fortunate that we've had so many talented people come through the paper. We have some people that are still around that have been involved for 10 or 20 years. And then we have a lot of new people always coming through, a lot of people that maybe participate for 6 or 12 months or a couple of years. And, maybe they're at a certain point in their life where they want to do something like this. Maybe they're exploring whether they want to pursue a career in journalism, or sometimes they're activists who, have important stories they want to share with the larger community. And we provide a platform for that as well. We also provide a platform for people CUNY professors who maybe have a certain area of expertise and want to reach a more general audience than they can through their academic activities and publications. And we're going to hear from one of them a little in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. Our first guest, Linda Martine Alcoff, who had a really brilliant article in our April edition called White Fright in a Changing World, Anti-Immigrant Movements Like MAGA Are Fueled by a Shared Concern. And she explores how white majoritarian societies like the United States and in Europe are freaking out over migration from former colonies and from the global south. And it's a really brilliant exploration of that. She's written on these themes.
Oh, she'll be interesting to speak with in a few minutes. And then you later have one of our officials on the air.
Yeah, we're going to hear in the second half of the show from State Senator Jabari Brisport, a Democratic Socialist who represents a district right here in the middle of Brooklyn. He was a middle school teacher and a political activist who was elected to the state Senate in 2020 and has really been a dynamic force in our state legislature. I spoke with him earlier today. The state legislature is sort of at the peak of its activity, trying to hammer out its annual $230 billion state budget. There's a lot of competing interests, and we had a chance to hear from Jabari sort of from the perspective of someone who's advocating for tenants and other
it's
people.
It's interesting when he talks. You'll hear when he talks about how many of the black population here in Brooklyn, where we're broadcasting from, are just leaving because they just can't afford to live here anymore. So that's all coming up in this interview that you have with him a little later on. Again, this is WBAI in New York. And, it's interesting to me that you still have a paper in print because so much media is going online.
Yeah, we're online,
and
too.
We're
doing all of that. We have independent.org, our website, we update mm-hmm. regularly. We have, Twitter and Instagram feeds we update, with reports from the streets when, in real time when protests are going on. Mm-hmm. And of course, we're doing this radio show. So we're on multiple platforms, but we still see value in being in print and being physically present in the city.
I think it's important for the paper to be in print. And you bring alternative voices just as WBAI does. And you're on this 5 o'clock strip, which is our New York City, New York State strip. You just heard, listeners, you just heard Inez Barron talking about a new program that she has on Friday with Charles Barron, bringing it, as she says. That's at 5 o'clock on Friday. So it's a really good lineup that we have, and we're so happy that The Independent is here with us. We have a minute or so before we go to our first interview to ask you to support WBAI. Please go to 212-209-2950. We have this matching fund that we're trying to match. We have another $200 on the last matching fund, and we have another $500 for this program to try to match. So we're looking for $800 to match to become $1,600 before the hour is up. So please help us, help WBAI keep on the air, help us to continue bringing you alternative voices, alternative views. And you have a wonderful person like John Tarleton here, editor-in-chief of The Independent, coming to you weekly, an important program, and we're asking for your support. 212-209-2950, and I'm going to be watching and looking for your support so that we can thank you on air as we go on to this next important interview with the professor.
Yeah, we're gonna talk with Linda Martine Alcoff in a moment. I just want to also say for listeners out there who listen regularly to the Independent News Hour each week, thank you so much for being loyal listeners. Today's a great day to show your support, not only for WBAI, but for this show, to show that you value the Independent News Hour and the kind of original local news that we consistently cover from one week to the next, and also the kind of sort of bigger picture thinkers that we bring on this show as well. So, the number 212-209-2950.
And the questions that you bring. to your guests, your questions that might not be asked anywhere else.
Absolutely. We have guests that have views to share that you won't hear elsewhere. And then, yeah, we try to bring thoughtful, probing questions that really bring out an information and analysis that you're not going to hear on other radio stations or other TV stations or wherever else you get your news. So it's always a great honor to do this show on WBAI. And so speaking of that, for our first segment, the politics of immigration continue to roil the Western world from the far corners of Europe to the U.S. southern border to here in New York City, where an influx of more than 140,000 migrants over the past year and a half or so has strained city services and cast doubt on whether our city still embraces its identity as a refuge for people from around the world. In the April print edition of The Independent, we have a fascinating article by Linda Martine Alcoff titled White Fright and a Changing World. Here's what keeps MAGA up at night. In her article, Alcoff writes, "We need to understand today's political crisis as epochal, rather than merely current and caused most fundamentally by the slow demise of the modern colonial world system." Linda Martine Alcoff is a professor of philosophy at Hunter College and the CUNY Graduate Center. She is the author of numerous books, including The Future of Whiteness and Race and Racism, A Decolonial Approach, which will be released later this year. She joins us now on 99.5 FM. Linda, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, John. Happy to be here.
It's always great to have you with us. So before we dive into this subject matter, just to set the stage a little bit, can you tell us about your own experiences of race growing up in Melbourne, Florida in the 1960s, and then later as an anti-Klan activist in the South, and how that informs your work?
Well, I came to the United States as a young child and moved in with my white mother's family. My father is brown and mixed from Panama. So my sister and I had a kind of a rude awakening, as so many people do who come to the United States, and finding our identities changing, our value changing, certain aspects of our visible appearance becoming very important. I never took these things for granted. I never took identity for granted. My mother's family is very poor, poor white, and I love them very much, and they were really wonderful, but they, you know, had some old ideas, and the South was churning up as I came here in the 60s and 70s, and I felt a desire to be part of the effort to root out racism, anti-black racism in particular, but all forms of racism from the United States. And so I got involved, and the Klan was on the march in the late 70s or mid 70s. They were growing. They were increasing, kind of like what you see today with the far right sort of marching and getting more support and articulating their views and updating their views from previous old ideas and having an impact.
Right. And what anything else you want to say about your activism in that era?
Well, it was scary and dangerous, but we were trying to find a way to make an alliance between people of color and white working class people. That was the goal of me and my comrades and a number of different groups and peoples working in the United States back then. And there were lots of grounds of that you could build from in terms of common interests, but it was a struggle.
Yeah, that's one of the perennial struggles in American history, is those attempts to form multiracial alliances against the ruling class, as it were. And we see that today with the attempt to unionize the auto workers in the South that's really gaining momentum, but also facing more opposition. But Let's go back and talk about that quote I read from a couple of minutes ago when I was introducing you about how today's political crisis around immigration is something that's epical and not a headline grabbing event of the moment. Can you elaborate on that analysis?
Yeah, I think it's a real mistake to date this from 2016 forward, right? When Trump emerged and actually took office. The right is no doubt organizing and gaining a lot of ground across Europe and North America. There's no doubt about it. But I think this is connected to an epochal change from the mid-50s. I start that article with a quote from Albert Camus in the late 40s, where he's expressing dismay at the fact that Europe's dominance and cultural dominance is on the wane. So I think that's the right framework to understand what's going on today, is the loss of Western dominance, the loss of Western faith, the loss of a sense of the legitimacy of Western dominance over the world. There's not only fighting back against Western dominance, there's also a fighting back against the narrative that the West invented science, invented philosophy, advanced political progress. Every year that becomes harder to maintain. It's never been really justifiable, but I think it's really losing its ability to control trade routes and financial markets and the public press and the discussions in the public sphere globally. It's losing its ability to control those things and to come out on top. And so I think what people are feeling as the crisis is real, the replacement theory gives an articulation of this, that white people are being replaced by immigrants. And I think we should take this very seriously, because there's a way in which it's true in the sense of what whiteness has meant, what white history have been told, what ideas people have about their lives and their families and their histories and the history of their coming to settle in this part of the world. All of these things are being very effectively challenged today and are losing ground and losing face and being replaced with different narratives and different histories, much more truthful, much more accurate, but it's creating a sense of anxiety and crisis. Where will I fit in this new world? Will I be respected? So the loss of dominance, what I find interesting is that the loss of domination is seen as a crisis. It's going to be unending war and chaos and disaster because the West has lost dominance, is losing dominance, and there's no going back from that. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be chaos and disaster.
Do you think that was reflected in sort of this very strong embrace of Israel after October 7th and the genocidal war they've unleashed on Gaza?
Yes, I think there's multiple reasons for that. But I think there's a way in which following Germany in this instance, addressing trying to appear to be addressing anti-Semitism in a serious way, provided a kind of moral alibi for Western dominance. I mean, remember, Germany is the richest country in Europe. Germany dominates the European Union. What right does Germany try to destroy Europe and pretty much destroy it itself have to rule Europe today? Its ability to position itself as the defender of the victims, of those that it victimized itself, is really key to its narrative of legitimacy. And I think similarly in the United States, there's a way in which Biden seems to believe, perhaps sincerely, that championing Zionism will be a moral card that showcases the United States as being on the right side of history. And of course, this is not believable to most of the world today, given what's happening.
Right. And closer to home, going back to your argument about sort of the changing cultural zeitgeist, I mean, a real inflection moment to me was when the New York Times came out with the 1619 Project and the right wing, I mean, it really freaked out and has really tried to repress the teaching of history anywhere in this country that they're able to have an impact.
Yes, I mean, I think we can make fun of Ron DeSantis all we want to, but he's a smart guy. He realizes that the curriculum of today's students is going to determine the politics of the next generation in this country. And so silencing the truth about our history, the complicated truth, because there's also great social movements of democracy and great social movements against racism in this country that have been influential around the world. But that's not the only story. And that those movements had to fight and risk their lives against the government, and the government support for the paramilitaries that were operating throughout the country from the Reconstruction right after the Civil War forward. So I just, you know, I think that just to say one other thing about Israel, one of the things that's similar between the Zionist government and Israel and our own is a certain toleration of ethno-nationalism, that the only, and I think this is what the far right is really putting forward today in this country and in Europe, the only way to secure the safety of white people is to have white majority in power, or maybe even white exclusivity in power, or Christian exclusivity in power. So it's ethno-nationalism that's really sweeping. That's sweeping in India, throughout Europe, and throughout the U.S., and it is, and ethno-nationalism is what Zionism is based on. The only way to have safety for Jews against anti-Semites is to have a state in which only Jews have the right to politically participate. And I think that's a false claim, and it's a dangerous claim to spread as a way for the West to move forward in these multiracial times.
Indeed. You're listening to the Independent News Hour on WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm John Tarleton. I'm speaking with Linda Martine Alkoff, a CUNY professor and author of The Future of Whiteness and Race and Racism, A Decolonial Approach. That book will be coming out later this year. She has an article in the current edition of The Independent called White Fright and a Changing World. If you would like to call in and join the conversation, call 212-209-2877. Again, that's 212-209-2877. We're going to have Linda on the air with us for a few more minutes, so join the conversation if you like. And Linda, bringing the this discussion closer to home, we also have a situation here in New York City where we've seen competing responses to the influx of migrants. There are many people who've worked very hard to reach out and welcome them and try to assist them. And then we've had other figures, including our mayor, Eric Adams, and his right-wing media allies like the New York Post, who have promoted a narrative of scarce resources being given to undeserving newcomers, as well as a narrative of danger and menace with the migrants. Can you talk about what we're seeing here in the city and how that relates to some of the things you've been discussing with us?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? New York, as they say, is really at risk of losing its identity as an immigrant city that has been welcoming, that has been so important with the Statue of Liberty out in the Bay, representing the ideal of accepting not just immigrants, but poor immigrants, right? That's been the narrative of New York and of the nation. And what's interesting right now is that how little this hysteria accords with the facts, because the crime that immigrants perpetrate is below the level of the general population. The fact is that the migrant explosion is going to on current estimates that I've seen, hand over $7 trillion to the U.S. economy. Unfortunately, will not be fairly distributed, but the point is our economy is going to benefit from the influx of immigrants. But these facts don't seem to matter and are not being shared by our political leadership, either the Democrats nationally or Eric Adams in the city.
Right. Emotions sometimes override logic. We have a caller on the line. A caller, can you give us your name and let us know where you're calling from and then your question for Linda Martin-Alkoff?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Oh, hear you fine.
Oh, great. Okay, so my name is Leah. I'm calling from the Lower East Side. I want to push back a little about this idea that Israel is a white power. If you're a Jew, you know that we come in every racial color, combination, ethnicity. And I think that a lot of people have a lot to say, but I feel like if you are not, if you've never been there, or even if you have been there, if you're from here and you think that Israel is a white state that's comparable with the European colonialism here, I think you're really not seeing through open eyes. I think that's a very United States perspective.
Okay.
Like our country has and I don't like the word race because it has no real scientific meaning, but for lack of a better word, our country sees through race or colorism. And every place is different. So I don't think that we can criticize places, but that really, those comments really feel to me like looking through a very United States perspective. And I think for white people right now to deal with what's happening here, and it's very easy to blame that on other people, and certainly Jews are always scapegoats. So I think that white Americans need to own their history and not blame it on Jews or Israel because it's inaccurate.
Okay, I really appreciate your questions and your comments on this. Let's give Linda Martin-Alkoff a chance to respond. Linda, your thoughts, are the Israelis being unfairly seen through a lens of colorism here?
Well, I agree in part in the sense that I don't think Jews are always seen as white. They're kind of like on the borderline, and sometimes they're on one side of the border and sometimes on the other side of the border, even in New York. I think the argument, though, that I've made and others have made does not necessarily hinge on the fact that Israel is seen as simply a white country and therefore gets special privileges from the U.S. because of its whiteness. There's other reasons that it gets special privileges that I listed, about the sort of being on the moral, trying to present themselves on the moral high ground, present the U.S. and Germany presenting themselves on the moral high ground by supporting Israel. But the other thing that makes Israel really relevant here is the ethno-nationalism. So whether or not Israel is white, whether or not Israel accepts multiple ethnic geographical lineage of Jewish people there. It's still a form of ethno-nationalism in that you have to be Jewish in order to have rights to own land and rights to vote. And that model, the idea that only safety can be guaranteed if you have uniformity of identity, if you have shared religion, right? That's the same idea that the white Christian nationalists use today, both in Europe and the U.S. So that's a commonality. However we understand Jews and Jewish history and the multiplicity of Jews, ethno-nationalism is the key to Zionism, and it is accepted without enough debate in the global north today.
Right. We have to go here in one more minute, but just bringing it back to New York City, your thoughts on the fact that the scapegoating of the immigrants here is led by our mayor, who is a black man, who is at the same time appealing to anxieties felt by some working class blacks in the city, as well as some people from Latino communities who feel like the newly arriving immigrants, are jumping the line, and those kind of feelings that he's stoking.
Right. I think that there are some legitimate issues that need to be talked about above board and worked out in terms of diverse segments of the working class and the way they're pitted against each other, and the way in which new vulnerable undocumented immigrants can bring down the wages of others. Those are issues that need to be worked through, because there are different segments of the working class that are made to compete, and we need to look at that structurally. And that's a legitimate issue. But scapegoating immigrants as the cause of our problems, as if without them things are going to be fine, is just not acceptable, whether it's from an African American, an Asian American, a Latinx person, or an indigenous person. We have to get more sophisticated about the way racism is an equal opportunity problem in every community, and every community has some racism against other groups that is a problem and that needs to be addressed.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there. But Linda Martine Alkoff, we thank you so much for joining us today on the Independent News Hour here on 99.5 FM.
It would be wonderful to have – hi, Linda. This is Linda Perry here with John. It would be wonderful to have a longer conversation with you. I'd love to hear what you think of the Netanyahu government when you talk about Israel and Jews and what's going on in Palestine and so many other issues. Can I just ask you, what do you teach? What is your subject that you teach?
I teach critical race theory and feminist theory and decolonial theory.
Wonderful. That's wonderful.
I'm the enemy.
not our enemy, that's for sure.
No.
Not our enemy. But thank you so much. And it was really good hearing from you. And I'd love you to just be on some other time and have our listeners engage with you some more, because I know that people want to talk to you. So, John, if you don't mind, I just wanted to say that to Linda. So appreciate your thoughts. And, there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of nervousness as white supremacists are losing their grasp. So thank you for bringing that to our audience.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed being here always.
Okay, thank you. And we'll be back with more after this short break.
Grass. The lunatic is on the grass, remembering games and daisy chains and laughs. Got to keep the loonies on the path. The lunatic is in the hall. Lunatics are in my hall. The paper. dishes to the floor. And every day the paper boy brings more. Is in my head. The lunatic is in my head. You raise the blade, you make the change, you rearrange me till I'm sane. You lock the door. Someone in my head, but it's not me.
And you're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI in New York. John Tarleton and The Independent is heard on Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Good interview, John, that you just conducted with the professor.
Thank you. Yeah, Linda Martin-Alkoff, she was fantastic, yeah, as usual.
And you have more to present, but I do want to thank those of you who are calling in and honoring WBAI with your pledges. And we so thank you for pledging to WBAI during this week, where we are trying to raise funds to pay down the debt that we've incurred with the transmitter, and where the transmitter is housed. $17,500 a month is what it costs. And so we are embarking on this fund drive this week and asking you to support WBAI. And if you call in now, whatever you contribute will be doubled. And we had a few callers, John.
Yeah, a little while ago, we received a donation from Bennett here in Brooklyn, and also John, not me, but another John here in Brooklyn.
And before that, Yvonne pledged her support. So WBAI has a matching fund right now, and we're asking you to please call and support this alternative space, this progressive space, this space that has existed since January of 1960. WBAI in New York, 212-209-2950 is the number to call to say, yes, I want to make an impact. I want to become a member of WBAI for $25 or more, worth $50 right now. I want to make a donation of any amount to WBAI to keep you on the air, to keep WBAI broadcasting today and into the future for future generations. There is a matching fund going on right now, and if you give us a call, we will be able to put that towards this matching fund that's in progress right now. 212-209-2950, or go to our website, WBAI.org, and you'll see there's a green square in the center of the page, and it says donate. So please do that. Do that right now. Go click on it and donate what you can to support WBAI, to keep it going, John. It's an important thing right now to keep WBAI on the air, alternative views, and you bring us people that we might not hear.
Absolutely.
Elsewhere.
Yeah, we do that every week here on the Independent News Hour. And of course, there's so many other outstanding news and public affairs show here on WBAI, especially during the 5 o'clock time slot every day, Monday to Friday, including the new show that's going to be starting with Charles and Inez Barron on Fridays at 5 o'clock. I'm really excited to listen to that. Charles Barron was always a treat to listen to when he served in public office here in the city. And of course,
Inez, a disruptor, which is what we love. He was a disruptor. Yeah, he still is.
He made good trouble, as did his wife, Inez Barron, who also served on city council and in the state legislature and will be co-hosting that show with him. So,
What about Jabari? Is he good trouble?
I would say so. I would say so. Jabari is one of eight Democratic socialists currently serving in the state legislature. They're almost all people of color under 40 years old, come out of social movement backgrounds. He was an activist for many years, also as a middle school math teacher. Forrest Souffrant Forrest was a nurse. Marcela Matania is another one of the socialists, was a tenant organizer in Sunset Park, whose family, her immigrant family, was evicted from their home by the landlord. The state rep didn't pay any attention to the protest they organized, and she ultimately ran for and took his seat in the state legislature. So that's the
good trouble.
That's the best kind of trouble to be making. And Jabari's a part of that crew. And I think he's been really outstanding in terms of following through on his commitments to represent a working class, a multiracial working class constituency in central Brooklyn. And, I had the chance to talk with him earlier today. In Albany, negotiations on the roughly $230 billion annual state budget have sailed past the March 31st deadline that's mandated by state law, and those negotiations remain deadlocked. Governor Kathy Hochul, Assembly Speaker Carl Heaste, and Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins and their staffs are negotiating behind closed doors while other legislators weigh in on the talks and try to influence what's happening. As I said, I spoke with Jabari Brisport earlier today and about how things are progressing. And I started by asking him about efforts to weave affordable housing policies into the budget and the competing claims of landlords and tenants about how to best address New York's housing crisis.
Yes, it is being referred to as a three-legged stool of new supply, of tenant protections, and additional other housing proposals involving, office conversions and legalizing of ADUs and basement apartments, many things like that. But I think probably the biggest sticking point is that progressives have been fighting very hard for many years for the Senator Salazar bill, Good Cause Eviction, which would help stem the massive rent hikes and unjust evictions we are seeing all across our state, especially in communities that are more at risk. And that has been deemed a problem for the real estate industry, which has fought tooth and nail against it. And, they're against it. So by extension, the governor has been against it. But we know that it must be, good cause eviction must be included in any housing deal.
How important is it for your constituents in your district that covers various neighborhoods in central Brooklyn?
I get emails all the time from constituents demanding that we pass good cause eviction. I've had people come up to me saying they've gotten rent increases as high as 100% in their not stabilized apartment, their market rate apartment. And these things are the biggest driver of people out of Brooklyn. If you look at the census, you will see that in terms of racial breakdowns, it is Black New Yorkers, Black Brooklynites, which are decreasing rapidly, especially over the past decade. And every single one I talk to says they are leaving because they cannot afford to live here. It is the cost of rent skyrocketing that is pushing people out. And so this is not just a justice measure. It's an anti-gentrification measure to keep people in their homes.
Right. And what should we make of these reports that there are people in the legislature and maybe the governor as well, pushing to roll back some of the rent law reforms that were instituted in 2019 that, for the first time in a long time, capped some of the excesses of the landlords?
Yeah, those people exist. Those legislators exist. That's happening. Those legislators alongside the governor are doing the bidding of the real estate industry and REBNY. whose goal now is to sort of trade any new protection guaranteed by good cause eviction by rolling back the protections guaranteed by the HSTPA in 2019. But progressive socialists, we are adamant that we will not pit one form of tenant versus the other. So we will not roll back protections for the rent stabilized tenants that got those in 2019 in order to gain new tenant protections for other tenants now. We need to protect all tenants and make sure they can stay in their home.
And do progressives and socialists in the legislature have enough power to enforce these demands?
This is an ongoing conversation. Why it's taking so long? We haven't seen a finalized budget bill that includes these rollbacks yet, because we are indeed still fighting to make sure that we are adding new tenants to protections, not trading tenants for protections.
Right. And we've also heard that there's been conflict between the Real Estate Board of New York and labor unions over wages for construction sites that might receive future subsidies. Is that also the case?
That is absolutely the case. The real estate industry is one of the most wealthy and powerful special interests in New York State, and they got that way by being incredibly greedy and sociopathic. So those characteristics are what they are bringing to housing negotiations. And what the specific thing is with labor is they do not want to pay workers, or they want to pay the workers the bare minimum possible in order to maximize their profits. And that's obviously, not going to fly for labor unions that are working to make sure their members can afford to live in New York, live in even the buildings they are building.
And as a socialist, what do you say to the real estate industry argument that if you give us as many subsidies as possible and as few restrictions as possible, we'll build the maximum amount of housing and we'll solve the housing crisis that way?
They did not even do that during the past 10 years of 421A. They were getting free money from the government in forms of tax abatements and subsidies, and were barely building any affordable housing. And the affordable housing they were building, some of it wasn't even affordable to the communities that it was placed into. So we have a literal record, the literal receipts, that they don't do that. And so there's no reason to believe they would start to do that magically. You get the same results from doing the same things.
Right. And moving on to another topic, where do things stand for the future of SUNY Downstate Hospital, which has been at risk of closure? There was a big rally of workers and community members that you attended on February 29th, a key healthcare facility for Brooklyn.
Yeah, Central Brooklyn needs more healthcare, not less. I am fully opposed to the closure of it that was proposed by the governor, and in both the One House proposals from the Senate and the Assembly, the closure was not proposed. It was actual funding for SUNY instead. And while I haven't seen us get to a final place on this, and I haven't seen the governor make any announcement that she is walking back the proposal to close SUNY Downstate, it is not over until we say it's over. And so continued pressure is absolutely necessary. And that's not just on the governor. That's on, if you're listening to your own legislators, to make sure we keep fighting to avoid the closure of SUNY Downstate.
Right. And that was leading into my next question, which is, at this stage in the process, are members still listening to their constituents, or is the process so sort of closed down with the three people in a room construct that the public, there's no place for the public in this?
It's a mix. And, for those who are listening and may not know three people in a room, we're at the point of negotiations where they are virtually entirely being conducted between the governor and her staff, the Speaker of the Assembly and his staff, and the Majority Leader of the State Senate and her staff. But at the end of the day, your legislator has a vote, and therefore we have a voice in the way negotiations can go and what the final budget bills will look like. So in terms of applying pressure, obviously the governor, but yes, to myself and to all, your current state legislators as well, to make sure we get the budget we deserve.
Right. And also, The group you belong to, the Democratic Socialists of America, the New York City chapter, y'all have 8 members in the state legislature and are looking to not only defend your current seats this year, but add 3 more insurgent outsider candidates and go into next year's legislature with 11 socialists. What difference would it make if there were 8 versus 11 socialists in next year's state legislature when we do this all over again?
You know, the more socialists we have, the more we can get done, because we work really well together and also in concert with strong, great advocacy groups outside. So I would just say, for counting the score in 2019 with just one socialist, Julia Salazar, working together with great organizations like Housing Justice for All, we were able to move the HSTPA. A couple years later, when we had several more socialists in office in concert with DSA and other groups, we were able to force new taxes on the rich to the billions of dollars. And when we added additional socialists 2 years later, we were able to do nation-leading Green New Deal legislation like the Build Public Renewables Act. So with more socialists, you can see the New York Health Act happening. You can see social housing being developed, and you can see free bus lines and free transit happening. You know, the more power we can exert for an agenda that works for all people, the better.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there. State Senator Jabari Brisport, thank you once again for joining us on WBAI Radio.
Thank you, John. I appreciate you.
Matt, always.
And that was State Senator Jabari Brisport speaking to the Independent News Hour earlier today about stalled New York State budget negotiations in Albany. The 3 hotly contested assembly races we referred to at the end of our interview involve Claire Valdez versus Joanna Carmona in District 37 in Western Queens, Ian Terrell Huntley versus incumbent Assemblymember Stephanie Zinerman in District 56 in Bedford-Stuyvesant, and Jonathan Soto versus Assemblymember Michael Benedetto in the Northeast Bronx around Co-op City. Valdez, Huntley, and Soto are running as socialists. And we will continue to follow these races and so much other local New York City news here at the Independent News Hour and in our print edition of The Independent. Linda, I know you've been taking a closer look at our current April edition, and
there's a fabulous Gaza protest spread in the center of this current issue, which I understand just hit the streets. Is it
about 10 days ago?
10 days ago. Okay, the March April 24 issue of the Independent, and it's great. So this was your reporting, which enabled you to take all of these photos and then put them together like this?
Yeah, like I said, the Independent, we're so fortunate. We have so many passionate volunteers that bring their skills and interests to the paper, and we've had several photographers out in the streets covering so many of the pro-Palestine Gaza protests over the last 6 months. And we took the best of some of their work and
that's fabulous.
Yeah, there's about, I think, 12 or 13 mm-hmm. photos in the center spread from all sorts of different moments. They capture some of the different spirit and people participating. It's such a broad-based movement for Palestinian liberation that we've seen in the streets. And so I think this photo essay really captures it. And it's one of the great things about newspapers. There's certain things you can do in a newspaper, like create that sort of photo spread. You can pull it out of the center spread and like put it on the wall in your house or your office or on your refrigerator. Or, of course, you can just pass the newspaper on to the next person when you're finished reading it. The physicality of it creates possibilities that you wouldn't necessarily see.
Yeah,
online.
And there's a half page photo of a subway car at the A train, right? With the heading under it, Mayor responds to subway disorder with call to give the NYPD more power. Now that grabs you because we all live it, right? We live it. You know, we know what's going on with the mayor and his attempt to make the subways safer when the statistics show that there's really not that much of a change in what has happened in the subway system.
Right, and we had the author of that article, Ted Hamm. He was on this show mm-hmm. several weeks ago mm-hmm. Previewing that article that I think he had, was working on at that time. Mm-hmm. So on this show, we're both able to bring writers on after they've published articles with us, before the articles are as they're developing them. We also bring sources on that they're talking to on many occasions. So again, we certainly appreciate all the listeners who appreciate what we're doing here on WBAI.
So come on, those of you who appreciate it. We have 4 minutes now. Reggie, you want to help us too? We have 4 minutes for people to call in 212-209-2950 and show your appreciation for John and all the work that the Independent News Hour team does. And we have a matching fund, so whatever you pledge is going to be double right now when you phone in.
212-209-2950. Again, it's programs like the Independent who does hard work on giving a perspective that is definitely unique and distinct from our counterparts in the corporate world as well as in the public world as well. But definitely, this is something that John and company do here on a weekly basis, giving you not just stories, but really deep dives into stories like what you have just heard right now. And if you appreciate what this show brings to the table on a regular basis, it's a great opportunity to show your support right now by calling 212-209-2950 or go to give to WBAI.org online. And just to remind people, we are appealing to the listening audience today and throughout the month of April is because we are behind the rent for our transmitter, and it is very important for us to catch up with this so we can continue on what we've been doing terrestrially as well as streaming. And that will, and your amount, your pledge of any amount will be greatly appreciated and will be especially appreciated during this time, during the hour of the Independent News.
And we have 2 minutes left.
And
2 minutes.
Not only be appreciated, it will be matched.
So it'll be matched. Double for double. Right. Like a dollar is $2. 25 is 50.
We all hear about inflation, but this is the good kind of inflation. Your $1 donation is worth $2.
212-209-2950. I see you about to go to your phone. I see. No. Go. Continue. You were just about to call us. Call us, 212-209-2950. We have a little over a minute left to match this match. 212-209-2950. About a minute more, and that way I can say to John, John, it's all good. We've made it. So let's call in. Let's boost the Independent News Hour here on WBAI. Let's boost WBAI. Let's continue broadcasting here on WBAI.
Yeah, I heard some of Berthold's comments before our show where he's talking about so many of the radio stations on the air now are like religious stations. You know, God help us if WBAI faltered and went
God
away.
God help us.
Well, somebody help us. Don't let WBAI falter. Don't let this station land in the hands of religious zealots or corporate media
at
time.
One point, yeah, well, there was somebody who was trying to do that, and I got so upset. This was
let's
this
keep
was
WBAI
when we first came back from
here for the people of New York.
2019,
unique,
and I said no.
Unique voices like the Independent News Hour and so many other great shows. I know we're going to be going to another great show here in just a little bit, but 212-209-2950.
Right.
212-209-2950.
If you love the Independent News Hour, now's
call
the time.
Call us. 212-209-2950 or go to our website, WBAI.org.
Thank you to those who've already given during this hour.
And thank you, John. You're always a pleasure to work with.
Likewise. It's always great to be here with you guys.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Reggie. This is WBAI New York.